Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Mal, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined, as always, by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Jack. It's a great spring day, and I'm glad to get back to recording our podcast. It's been a while since we did one.
Took a slight hiatus.
We did, yeah. I started off by being out of town in Europe for so long, you know. But
right.
Then when we got back, we found that we had to go back out of town again. So it's been a few weeks since we've been able to record.
All these vacations we just take.
Oh, I wish it were vacations. It's all work.
You need a vacation from your trips.
That's right. That's right. Some people go on vacation by going on a trip. I go on vacation by not going on a trip.
Hey, that's called a staycation.
A staycation.
There is actually a term for it.
That's great.
Millennials
that's great.
Come up with all kinds of interesting terms.
Yeah, millennials, you millennials are so hop and groovy and stuff.
We come up with all kinds of terms, like life hack.
Oh, yeah, right. Or adulting.
Adulting.
Have you heard that one? Adulting?
Yes. Some of them are brilliant. I like them.
Yeah.
I like them a lot. Believe it or not, this episode is not about life hacking. We just like to talk to each other.
We just like to talk. Yeah, we haven't talked to each other.
Because we're people, okay? We have lives and we have personalities. We don't need you judging us.
Well, you do. I've been told I don't have a personality.
Right. You're just, people don't know, there is no Hodges. There's just a bot.
That's right.
Says Hodgian things. Just real quick, there is a story about a guy. Some guys who like program two bots, you know,
to talk to each other.
To talk to each other, and you know, people who don't understand this, it's like an online. It's basically just like a very simple AI that's built to like respond in comment sections and messaging threads and stuff like that, and also apparently screw with people during election season. But they built two bots and just got them to talk to each other and see what would happen. And it ended with both the bots accusing the other of being a bot.
What?
Being a bot. Like, I think you're a bot. No, you're a bot. I was like, this is about wondering if there's going to be an existential crisis. Where they both were.
I think that's fantastic. And neither of them claimed that they were themselves bots.
Huh? I don't think so.
That's amazing.
That's very
sort of unaware, unself-aware.
Right.
Bots. But very aware of the other guy.
Very aware.
Boy, that's very human, isn't it?
It is.
I can see your flaws better. I can see mine, that kind of thing.
Yeah, even when we try to program things,
that's
can't help
funny.
But kind of reflect us a little
that's
bit.
Amazing. You know, actually, that kind of plays into what I'd like to talk about today, about what it means to be human.
Really?
Humanities.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're talking about what you learn in the humanities department at the university these days, and what used to be and what it is now. And I was just reading in Timothy, 2 Timothy, a description that I thought was, I mean, it's all of the negative things, but I was trying to think about how these things might go about laying out a picture of what it means to be a human being. In 2 Timothy 3, it says, But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. And I thought, what a picture of the decline of a people. You know, he's talking about the last days we can look at the last days as last days. You could look at it as a kind of description of the
eschaton
of the
right?
Last
days,
the capital, literal last days,
capital T.
And who knows? These might be the literal. We never know, right?
Yeah,
we're not making a prediction about when he's coming back,
right?
But at the same time, even if he's not coming back for another five millennia, which we can't possibly know. We could still see the decline of smaller sets of humanity in somewhat the same way, can't you?
Right. A civilization collapsing out is very apocalyptic.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Especially being that, because apocalypse is about revealing things. It's like a revelation of all the ways it's gone wrong. You know, all the corruption becomes apparent and the veneer like goes away. So even if, you know, there are people who want to play, oh, we're in the last days, because I think somehow if America collapses, that's the end of the world.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, it would be a big thing, but I don't think that's quite what the book of Revelation is talking about.
Right.
But there is a way to apply it that even in sort of small A apocalypses, you know, where a civilization collapses, it probably looks just like this, because a civilization collapses, insofar as it turns away from the good. And the good is ultimately God, particularly God revealed in Christ. So the less Christ-like a civilization becomes, the more it falls apart, and thus the more it's going to look anti-Christ, if I could put it that way. That spirit, the spirit of Antichrist is not just going to be some dude at the end of time, which, you know, there's going to be that, but it's also just a general spirit of anti-Christ-likeness.
You
know, the, whatever Christ is, and thus whatever God is, it's the opposite. So that's what a civilization collapsing would look
and
like.
And don't and doesn't it look a little bit like, eventually, like the characteristics of this anti-Christ are actually the characteristics of being anti-human? Or to put it in the positive, the more we look like Jesus, the more human we are.
Yes.
It's like he's the model of humanity. Well, then if the less you look like him, the more you're going to be some of these things. Lovers of self instead of lovers of others, right?
Right.
Lovers of money rather than recognizing the value of money, but not seeing it as the end, the goal of...
Right.
In fact, you and I were talking just now about the problems with the sort of socialist versus capitalist mindset today. We've brought it up in past podcasts too, but it might be worthwhile to speak about that here now.
Sure.
What were you, tell us about what you were saying. The capitalism actually can be have its problems under certain circumstances, but it feels like if you were to call capitalism a problem in some ways, you're immediately going to be called a socialist.
Right.
But, and the reverse.
Right. Right? Well, I was saying that in my own sort of journey as a conservative and a Christian, as a traditionalist conservative and a Christian, I keep running into this very frustrating thing. And part of this is from, you know, reading conservative materials and ideas and being surrounded by non-conservative academics and intellectual types who, to a man or a woman or non-binary specific person, is Marxist to some extent.
Right.
Right. So I've been surrounded by both of those kind of worlds. And what I've realized is that, you know, I've become more and more convinced of Marxism's, the way I put it is that fundamentally it's irrational and immoral, which is a philosophic statement. It's not like, I remember just on Facebook I said that and someone wanted to say, where's your evidence for that? And I realized, I realized that you could point out evidence, but I realized that my statement of like Marxism being immoral and irrational is not an analytical or statistical statement. It's a philosophic one.
Right.
So I could point up things about like how many people it's killed, but they could just throw back like, well, capitalism's killed it or whatever, or something like that. You know, we could just go back and forth with data, but it's a philosophic statement. It's about its fundamentally materialist worldview, which is A, irrational because it can't account for the mind, which means it can't account for thought, and thus it can't account for the validity of even thought, even itself.
Yeah.
And then B, it's immoral because it reduces human beings to just material objects shaped by material forces, and thus it dehumanizes them.
Absolutely.
And so I get more and more convinced that Marxism is wrong. But the issues they point out with like a capitalistic society, I can't exactly disagree that those things are bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a consumerist culture is bad. A worldview that really is based on your own self-interest and just gaining profit, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not good. Like, that's going to end in something not good.
Well, that kind of capitalism, if that's what the people mean by capitalism, then it isn't all that different at its root than socialism, because they're both materialistic.
Yes, they're both materialisms at bottom.
Right.
The kind of there's like a free market economics that's buttressed by some sort of moral order that's other than itself.
Right.
Right, because free market economics really, I don't know, almost in some way you could say it's amoral because it's not interested in those metaphysical questions. It's just like, how are we going to organize buying and selling, right, in some way?
Yeah.
It's almost like mechanistic in some way.
That's right.
And so you buttress it with a moral order, like say a Christian moral order.
That absolutely
says, okay, in all your dealings you're going to be fair. And oh, by the way, agape love is the great summum bonum because God is agape, right? And Christ-likeness is God, loving neighbor, loving the brethren and sistren, loving your enemies.
If you buy on the front end that loving someone other than yourself is key to all moral behavior, then that necessarily puts limits around whatever the economic system
is. And you might do something that makes absolutely zero sense to somebody who's like a capitalist but doesn't have that moral structure. You know, you may give away a whole bunch of money to help out someone and it's a loss for you, but you did it anyway.
Right.
And they're like, that doesn't make any business sense. Well, there's something bigger than business sense.
That's the
more
point.
Important.
That's the point.
So you have that, but there is a kind of capitalism out there that has no moral buttressing outside of itself. It's kind of a libertarian, Ayn Randian, objectivist sort of version of it that somehow thinks not that market economics is like just the best way we have so far of organizing ourselves, but rather it is the summum bonum that's going to save the world if we just spread it around as part of let it go. It's going to like bring about peace on earth and the best kind of human beings. If everybody just pursues their own self-interest, it'll all turn out okay.
Right. Yeah, that's like basically that. Ayn Rand's
and
approach.
I looked at that and I'm like, you know, that really does kind of end in a consumerist culture that devalues everything. As Switchfoot put it, when there's nothing is sacred, there's nothing to lose. When nothing is sacred, all is consumed, right? And in that sort of system, there really is, it's materialist, like you said. So there really is nothing but the production and consumption of goods, and you're trying to produce as much and consume as much as you can, more than the other guy, because that's how you survive.
Right, right.
That's not good. That's almost animalistic in some way. So I looked at it, and I was like, you know what? There is something wrong with consumerism, and there is something... You know, without a Christian moral buttressing around it, where are the guardrails that would stop greed or exploitation of people that are down on the, or something like that? You know, or just dumb moves that, you know, hurt people down the food, down the chain of command, and you just don't think about it or something like that.
So it's possible to have a system where you're asking the right questions, but then and seeing the problems that are apparent properly, but offering a solution that is
totally
useless.
Off the mark. And that was I realized with my Marxist peers.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Is that they were actually asking really good questions.
Sure.
It's just the sort of diagnosis they came up with and the solutions was just horrifyingly off.
I had one of our Sunday night conversations was with some folks who were atheists, and they were saying, this is the problem, these are the problems with the status quo. And I couldn't argue. I said, yeah, that's, you know, sin is sin. It really is apparent, and all people are sinful. But and they thought, oh, good, they're on my side. He's on my side, right? He's going to come along with me. And their solution was that we all have to build a big spaceship and go to another planet and start all over again. And I suddenly said, check, please, you know, that's enough of this. Well, but that's it. I mean, they may point out the right problems, but then they think the only solution is like the only solution they can imagine is, you know, tax the rich, or the only solution they've got is communism, or the only solution is to get in a rocket ship and go somewhere else.
Or build a giant computer that
build
solves
a giant
the
robot.
Problems for- I want to sit there and be like, you know, those type of solutions are why dystopian sci-fi literature exists.
Exactly.
Right?
It's like, exactly. Let's try them out.
our complete failure to save ourselves.
Oh, boy.
So the frustration was recognizing that actually there is a breed of free market economics that is divorced from any moral order outside of itself, and it's insufficient to provide it, but it tries.
Yes.
And there are people who, very smart, intelligent people, who try to... I was listening to like a Dave Rubin podcast where he had some just straight up Ayn Randian objectivists trying to argue about why selfishness is a virtue. And it was the most mind boggling bit of gymnastics I'd ever heard. Either the way they did it, I'm like, no, or they defined selfishness in such a way that nobody in the history of ethical philosophy has ever defined selfishness.
Kind of the Gordon Gekko approach to
like that. But that's
enlightened self-interest.
Yeah, that's a Wall Street reference. For
Wall Street reference.
That is.
Yeah.
So I looked at it and I realized there are problems, but the Marxist solutions were not solutions. So I was like, well, there's got to be a conservative Christian critique of market economics and the problems that go. But I find that if you try to critique it, there are a whole ton of conservative Christians who just assume you're being Marxist.
Right.
Right.
It's tempting.
And this is a little history lesson for everyone. In the 20th century, conservatism and libertarians and classical liberals and objectivists all saw Marxism as the same bad thing. And even though they had internal disagreements with each other, they realized they had to unite against a common enemy, and they
That's
did.
That's it.
That was basically That's like it. William F. Buckley and his fusionism. Right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
He could stand in the same room with Ayn Rand, even though they kind of disagreed on a bunch of stuff.
Sure.
Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union... And, you know, Marxism is no longer some sort of, like, outer political force. It's more like a cultural force now. We suddenly start to realize our differences. And I'm starting to realize that, you know, free market economics are not sacrosanct, okay? They're not perfect. They're not the summum bonum.
To be the summum bonum, it's got to be, you got to idolize it. You got to take God out of the picture and put it in his place.
Right. And so the thing
and
is.
And it can't support that.
It can't. And the thing is open to critique and problems and stuff that we need to recognize. And yet there seem to be a whole strand of people that if you even dare touch it, you're a Marxist. And I'm like, is there such a thing as like, is like, if I touched it, then I'm a Marxist. But when I say Marxism is irrational, then I'm like, well, I'm just, you know, confirmation bias for like, you know, free market economics.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'm sitting there like,
you can't win either way.
Is there such a thing as like economic Mullenism? Like it's just kind of like a third way that we could just go through the shoot the gap, you know, in some way. And it's this, it is this kind of like a recognition. It's like people, there needs to be an ability, which I have very poorly, but I'm trying to recognize larger principles than some man-made system, which capitalism, socialism, whether you like them or not, or whether you agree with them or not, or you think they're the suna bonum or not, they're ultimately man-made, human-made, non-binary specific, human-made. Oh gosh, what a frustrating time to live in. They're both human-made systems.
That's right.
Which means they are both, even if socialism wasn't the problematic thing we think it is, it still would be open to critique because it's ultimately a fallen system because it's made by fallen people. And at some point, it's going to fail, right?
Well, and all of this that you're saying is comes out of this little phrase, lovers of money. They would be, in the last days, they'll be lovers of money.
Yeah.
And I, beyond that, I think it's lovers of money, that is lovers of the material benefit that money can buy, too. And so it's lovers of material, right? Lovers of this world, basically.
Right. Mammon is probably
and the power that you can get from
it's probably the best word for it.
Mammon.
Material stuff, right?
That's
that was
right.
literally the dichotomy that Jesus put. You can't, you're either a lover of God or you're a lover of material stuff.
You can't actually love both masters simultaneously.
You can't do it.
But so you can see how if you take God out of the picture and you are a lover of mammon, then the whole spectrum of between communism on one end and
objectivism
or something like that on the other end, the sort of Ayn Randian sort of thing. All of that is a spectrum now, and we have to try and figure out how to balance that all out. But it's really not, the answer isn't on that line anywhere.
Yeah.
It's a higher thing. You would put God first back into the picture, and like you said, that puts a moral a cover or a fence around whatever economic system we take. And then we see the economic system for what it is. It's a very small thing. It's compared to God, I mean.
And
it's a very small thing, and it only is helpful if it remains a small thing.
And that's what...
And a free market would be a good thing under the circumstances.
That's what the humanities are supposed to do, is you that larger thing that can step outside of all this stuff and look at all this. It gives you that ability to have that bigger view.
What the humanities do is doubt the assumption that mammon is the only thing to live for.
Yeah.
Right? Because all the debate you were just talking about is within the compass of mammon is what we're here for.
Right.
We all assume that. It's just a question of whether you're going to go left or right.
Right. Well, even if you're not Christian, the humanities as the repository of human wisdom.
Right.
You know, as of centuries, millennia of wisdom, is a place to learn that, you know, people say it gives you a larger perspective, which sounds very platitudinous. But as we hopefully just practically demonstrated, it gives you a different perspective on the capitalist-socialist argument. You can you're actually free of swearing fealty to either one of those things. And you're also free from just, you know, derogatorily demonizing either of those things. You can actually see. It's like a way of being able to see. For the Christian in particular, it's interesting because the humanities is not just simply collected wisdom, because part of that collected wisdom includes Scripture and includes Revelation, which includes Scripture, but also includes Christ.
That's right.
And Christ, as you said, is what true humanity is supposed to look like.
That's right.
God came down and modeled that for us. This is what it means to look like in full love and communion with God as embodied in space and time. This is what that looks like.
And he embodies the things that were just the opposites of the things I was just reading in 2 Timothy. That is, he's not boastful. He's not proud. Here we're told he's God incarnate, and at the same time, he's not proud. Imagine.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if anybody had the right to be proud, you know, it would be God, right? But that's not even part of his character, which is astonishing. So should lead us to a recognition that pride in ourselves is really a very evil thing.
So humanity is supposed to give you a larger context, a larger principle.
Right.
For the Christian, Christ is that larger principle and larger context, so to speak.
That's
he
right.
is the
that's
truth.
Right.
And thus, the humanities, in some way, shape, or form, if I could put it this way, is almost like the Old Testament because it's in some way, shape, or form about him.
Mm.
Now, it could be about moving towards him or moving further away. but it is ultimately about him. You can look at, you can read Homer, and you can read the Odyssey, and you can get the idea of like the Xenos or the Xenia covenant and the idea of hospitality, and you can see Christ in there, mm-hmm. right? You made this mm-hmm. argument before. We're like condensing one of your big arguments, but you've said before that when Jesus said, you know, I am the vine and you are the branches, and he was speaking metaphorically, he wasn't doing it arbitrarily. I mean, you've said this before. Right, like he wasn't just looking around saying, oh, what's a good, vines and branches. I guess that'll work. It's like, no, if Jesus is the creator of vines and branches, and even in that very moment as the Logos, is the only reason they're still sustained at all in the moment.
Right, right.
Which suggests that the reason he picked vines and branches is not because it was a convenient image, but because that's actually... vines and branches are actually supposed to be an image of true communion and relation. Like he built it to be that way.
That's right. That's right.
And so there actually is like a reality behind it that he's pointing at that's real. It's not just arbitrary, like, oh, that's just a convenient image. No, I designed vines and branches because you are going to have a constant metaphor all around you of a deeper truth, the reality of ultimately the Trinitarian life of God, but then that life he wants us to share in that communal life with him.
And that's the astonishing thing about Revelation, right. that he's revealing himself, but he's also revealing himself in the material world, because he's always talking about himself. If you want to know the Father, you have to be willing to hear the revelation about him, that he's a king, or that he's a shepherd, or that he's
a lover.
A lover, exactly. Right. Or a friend, or a brother, or a vine, right. or a
adversary.
Even an adversary.
Like he stands against
he's
you.
He's the bread of life.
He's the door.
He's the door, you know. So all those things are material things that somehow gain meaning, triple meaning now, extra meaning. Because of the fact that they are references to something beyond themselves. And if you take God out of that equation, we actually are collapsing the entire creation itself, like a house of cards, to their own material meaning. Right. And alone, the material meaning doesn't have enough to go on.
There's nothing to point to but itself.
Exactly.
Beyond it. If you take that all of existence being the creation of God, and thus the, you know, general revelation, but still revelation of God, that makes all of existence a metaphor for God.
Yes.
One that is marred and distorted because of sin, but is not completely eradicated and gone. It's like you can still see it. The heavens still declare his glory. His invisible attributes are still clearly seen in all that is made. And Jesus is the ultimate and the most perfect metaphor for God, if I could speak that way without people thinking I'm being irreverent. He is the ultimate, like, pointer to God, because he was God in human form.
That's right.
All right?
That's right.
If that's the case, then that says something about metaphor and about existence and about humans' exploration of existence. Because we believe, if I could put it this way, all art is metaphor.
That's right.
All right? The metaphor is not just that thing you learned in elementary school, like, you know, it's like a simile, except it doesn't use like or as or something like that, which is the most... It's the dumbest thing to like. Oh, that's all it is? Oh,
it's
okay.
Like describing a human being as a featherless biped.
It's like, oh,
it's true.
That's true. Oh, I got it. I got it now.
But it's by no means comprehensive.
All art is metaphoric, because all art is about the embodiment of ideas.
That's right. Invisible things made manifest.
Even if the thing you're trying to embody is that there are no ideas to embody, you're still embodying it some way in your painting and your music and your sculpture and your play and your movie and your video game and your blog entry, your essay.
Absolutely.
Right? Whatever. You're trying to embody some kind of idea. If that's the case, then if all of existence is supposed to be a metaphor for God, but it's marred by sin, then that shapes the way you view the collection of human wisdom, which is all these metaphors trying to embody certain ideas. And you're trying to look for or see things in the light of Christ, who is the truest expression of God, the truest metaphor of God. You see, people would ask, like, well, humanities are supposed to give you this larger principle to let you step outside of things. Mm-hmm. But how can you possibly do that? Aren't you always inside of things and always trapped within language and in with the humanities tradition? There's the subjectivist problem. You know, right. We're not infinite. Right. It's like, you're right. You're right. You're right. I can't step outside of things, get the ultimate principle. Gee, if only the ultimate principle had agency of its own, it could come to me. That would solve the whole problem, right?
Yes, it would.
Well, that's what revelation and incarnation is the ultimate principle.
Right.
You see the quotation marks I'm making with my hands. Turns out to actually be a person who came to us. That notion, it's not that it just gives Christians their own way to view the humanities. It just completely changes the way you see all art in everything. Mm-hmm. So humanities is about having that larger thing, getting that larger thing, and developing that larger thing that you can see more clearly through. And for a Christian, Christ is that larger thing. So all of the humanities is, like I said, in some way, shape, or form, about him. Even the things that are, in essence, anti-Christ can still make him sharper in the same way that, you know, a dark room can suddenly make a candle stand out brighter. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So something that is just purely diabolical in its intention can actually just make who Christ is shine out even sharper. Everything Timothy's talking about is anti-Christ. It's diabolical.
Right.
And yet somehow, as you're saying, if we take those negatives and flip them on their head, it makes Christ more apparent. It makes it sharper.
And the characteristics that he's complaining about in people are really the absence of Jesus in them, in the sense you're talking about. That is, the humanity of Christ, it's the absence of the humanity of Christ in us, which means that as we degenerate like that, what we mean by degeneration is a lack of humanness in us.
Yes.
So we become more proud, or we become more lovers of ourselves, or we become more lovers of money, and so on and so on. All those things seem to be descriptions of the lack of humanity in us. And it leads me to a description of the humanities that I read online once from reference.com. I thought I'd read it to you. You can hear what they say. The humanities are, quote, the study of human culture through art, literature, philosophy, music, and languages, period.
Okay.
Okay. Then they sort of expand on it a little bit. The humanities provide a greater insight into the world at large. Students of the humanities learn how to examine different facets of the world, to think more critically, to ask questions. A humanities education can help enhance an individual's understanding of nearly anything, from politics to painting. The humanities explanation of the human experience adds to the overall understanding of the world. End quote. That's from reference.com, in case anybody wants to look it up and see.
That's not half bad.
Well, yeah. It's actually better than what a lot of universities, just hearing about UCLA, and you can get a degree in the humanities, but you must take several classes, and they are, you know, a class on racism, a class on post-colonialism, a class on, white privilege and gender politics and transgenderism.
You have to learn that humanities are about power, and you have to learn who's been in control of those power structures and power, in those discourses, and use them for their own purposes.
And you would think then that wouldn't go along with this, but I think this definition we just got here is probably generic enough to even include their take. The study of the human culture through art, literature, philosophy, music, languages. Well, yeah, you study those things in order to see how people oppressed each other in the past.
Right.
You know.
You ask questions.
You ask questions, exactly.
Why
you examine different facets of the world.
Why should I read dead white cisgendered males or something?
Exactly. Why do I have to listen to Mozart?
Right. Didn't he, like, steal things? Like, didn't he just steal his music from some, you know, woman or something like that? I'm pretty sure he did.
Right. Or just sucked all the oxygen out of the air so that no woman could have a chance to compose.
Sure.
He was oppressing women by
actively suppressing.
Yeah, yeah.
People could get tenure.
It's astonishing, these kind of assumptions. But they seem to be still within the sort of general definition that I see here in this reference.com thing. So what I was thinking about was, how can we address what's good in this? Mm. And then how can we, you know, correct what maybe needs correcting or expand on what needs to be expanded on?
Well, I mean, the obvious good one is already what we said. It seems to definitely suggest that the humanities is providing you some kind of larger perspective.
Yes.
You know, your ability to sort of step outside of it. Northrop Frye would call it like the educated imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, your ability to sort of be bigger than the town you're in and the country you're in, the civilization, and to like have some kind of larger perspective that doesn't necessarily mean you abandoning your town, your country, or hating it. Necessarily.
Right, necessarily.
But at least you have this larger perspective, so you don't get sucked into something that's negatively parochial or like is
provincial.
Provincial. That is truly narrow-minded and not good.
Right.
You know, so
right.
like that. It's like at least you have this bigger perspective. So the immediate good is that it still is saying, look, this is about giving you this larger vision. It's about helping you see.
Like, well, it sounds a little like what you were saying before about how you want to be able to get outside of yourself a little bit, your own experiences and so on. And how and most of postmodernism says you can't do that, right? You can't get beyond yourself. But I sometimes think it's a matter of degree. You can let me put it this way. I've taken to using the word apprehend things instead of comprehend things.
Yes.
Because comprehend implies you got it all.
Total knowledge.
Exactly. So it seems like if you buy into a kind of a vision of knowledge as comprehensive, then you understand why the postmodernist says you can't do that. There's no way you can possibly do that, right? You have to agree. Well, nobody knows everything.
Right.
So you can't get outside of yourself perfectly. But then is the only other response to say, well, then if you can't get outside of yourself perfectly, you really can't know anything at all.
Right.
Well, no, that's not quite right either.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to say we can apprehend some things. We can hold. That's what apprehend means, to hold things, certain things, but without necessarily knowing everything.
Yeah.
Be sure of what we know.
I've become more and more convinced, and it was in my PhD studies, that I'm more and more convinced that not understanding the comprehension, not understanding the notion of apprehension as opposed to comprehension is a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is, even the postmodernist, I've mentioned this before, that the postmodernism really is just a product of the Enlightenment because it still buys into the Enlightenment, a bunch of Enlightenment notions. It just thinks that they can't be accomplished. So it buys totally into the notion, into the notion. That real knowledge is some sort of total comprehension and objectivity.
Right.
It totally agrees with that. It just thinks we can never achieve
it. Can't be done.
Because we can't. Like, regret. Their argument is succinct. But if comprehension is not the only thing that's there, if there's such a thing as apprehension, you know, the verse I constantly use is Paul saying, right now we know in part.
Yes.
Which is an astounding statement. It's like, if it's in part, then how do you possibly know? You do.
Yeah.
There is such a thing as approaching something that's incomprehensible, like God, and you can still have true knowledge, like actual knowledge of true things, even though there's still mystery. So there's mystery and truth, and the mysteries do not negate the truth. As a matter of fact, if you learn more about the mysteries, they're not going to negate the truth. They're simply going to build on and enrich them.
Yes.
All right? That's the proper way to approach the world, that you can know things, but you can't know everything.
And if you understand that, then you don't have to fall into the trap of either embracing the Enlightenment optimism that you can know everything, or the sort of postmodern pessimism, as it were, about not being able to know everything, so why bother trying to know anything at all?
Right.
It's a little bit like that whole socialism versus capitalism argument you were giving before. Either I have to embrace capitalism without any kind of moral compass, or I have to be a socialist, one or the other. And is that why really, why are there all these false dichotomies? Why isn't there a third way?
I know. It's like now we need metaphysical Molinism.
Right. That's right. Well, I gave this some thought, and I'd really like to read you what it is that I came up with. I'd like to be able to rewrite a definition for the humanities. Take a listen, see what you think.
I'm listening.
You remember the old one? I'm just going to read you the old one. It's such a short one. It says, humanities are the study of human culture through art, literature, philosophy, music, and languages. Good.
Got it.
And then the humanities provide a greater insight into the world at large, and it gives you some things that students are going to gain from the humanities. Learn how to examine different facets of the world. Mm-hmm. Think critically. Ask questions. Enhances a person's understanding of nearly anything, it says, from politics to painting. Mm-hmm. The humanities examination of the human experience adds to the overall understanding of the world, which is
that's the most vague.
That's almost useless, that last one, I think. But never mind.
In sum, it's a study of human culture to gain greater insight and understanding about the world.
That's right. What I was thinking was this. The humanities are, now this is my quote, okay? The study of human culture through art, literature, philosophy, music, and languages, like they said, for the purpose of reflecting on what we are supposed to be. Our purpose, the meaning of our existence, and the fulfillment of the design to which we were made to live what used to be called the good life. Even if you want to take Aristotle.
Yeah, the... eudaimonia.
Eudaimonia, right. The life that values the material in its proper place and aspires to things beyond it, like character, wisdom, and virtue.
Right.
The humanities provide a greater insight into the world God has made. That's what they said, right? Right. And I'm expanding on that. Students of the humanities learn to see the entirety of reality, both the visible and the invisible parts. They will learn to examine the material world in order to metaphorically see both it and through it to the spiritual world that cannot be seen, which is the point you were making a minute ago.
Right.
They will learn to think critically and ask questions in order to discern the truth and learn to apply that truth to all aspects of their lives, which might be called wisdom.
Right.
A humanities education can help enhance an individual's understanding of nearly everything, anything, like they said, not only from politics to paintings, which I think is a kind of a narrow field, if you think about it too much, but from one end of the human experience to the other, from the earth to the stars. And then finally, it will show the harmony. Study of the humanities will show the harmony in widely disparate things, connecting theology to thorns, washing dishes to redeeming the world, fairy tales to heaven.
Right.
The humanities examination of the human experience adds to the overall understanding of the nature of man and his place before his creator, giving him purpose and a lifetime's worth of satisfying work that would train him, that should train him for eternity.
Right.
End quote. What do you think?
I think what's been added is, the immediate thought was that there's a moral order to the way you're viewing it.
That's right.
Because the original quote is like, we don't disagree, but it's like you said, a better understanding of the world, but it doesn't specify any understanding. So your understanding could be anything.
Right.
Right? It leaves the door open to like, well, get a greater understanding, but it's, you know, whatever greater understanding you come to, including like, you know, an impression narrative or an Ayn Randian objectivist narrative, whatever. But here, there's a bunch of assumptions that there is a order to things and a created order and a design and a telos and a direction. It's not about getting a greater understanding. It's getting a greater understanding of the truth, which implies that there is a truth and that we can know the truth of becoming the kind of creatures we're meant to be, implies a telos to our, that we're created and that there's some kind of, there's a moral order to that whole thing that is assumed there. And I don't mean that pejoratively assumed. It's like we all have our presuppositions.
Sure. It's consciously assumed.
And you're consciously doing that.
Right.
So it's like, it's almost like the original definition was like an empty form, and then you take it and you actually fill it with some kind of substance, and thus it becomes more specific. It's still a broad definition, but it's more specific than even the original definition.
It should encompass all aspects of human endeavor and draw insights about all that. But it seems to me, without that extra, like you said, moral kind of set of assumptions, no study of the humanities will ever generate meaning.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, why should it surprise us that fewer and fewer students are going into the humanities?
Yeah.
If there's no meaning to be found there, it's just a kind of intellectual exercise that you do, like a Sudoku puzzle or something. It just entertains your little gray cells, as Poirot used to say.
Yeah, and you should just, if you had a choice between entertaining your brain cells by like trying to doing a crossword puzzle and unpacking Shakespeare, well, then why wouldn't you do a crossword puzzle?
Right.
It takes up less time. You know, I got work to do, man. I got time to, if it's really just intellectual exercise, now the way I would just express it is that the reference.com definition is a truly secular definition in that it's trying to be just completely neutral, which it's not, because its assumption of neutrality actually has a whole bunch of theological and metaphysical assumptions about things. But it's trying to be neutral, and your definition is not neutral.
No.
It's taking a side and saying, no, there is a meaning to existence, and we are built to know it and built to become it in some way, and the humanities are part of how we do that.
Well, I think I agree with you, but I think when I
look
at... I'm glad. But I think rather than thinking that theirs is a generic and sort of open, could go in any direction, kind of not choosing sides sort of way to do it, and mine is choosing a side, I'd like to think, I mean, I really do think, that theirs is void of any kind of purpose. Yeah. To it. The what they say, the closest they get is to something like greater insight into the world.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, oh.
But there's no assumptions. Well, it's, they hide their assumptions if they're there. There's no assumption that there is a world there to know, or that knowing it would be a better thing than not knowing it.
Right.
You know, maybe they're assuming those kinds of things.
Which is why the secular claims to be neutral, but it's not.
It's really not.
It actually is making a big statement about
existence. And my version of it, I think, is trying to... not just sort of take a side and fight from that corner, as it were, but because I wasn't actually giving specifics about what those virtues are.
Yeah.
I was just saying there are those, which I'm, that's my side, if there's a side. There are those things to know, and knowing them actually gives your life meaning.
Yes.
See? So the exploration of the humanities shouldn't take the place of revelation. And so in that way, you're exactly right. I'm assuming revelation and the way of the world, the look of the world from the point of view of revelation. But then the study of the humanities is an expansion of myself into a world that is pregnant with meaning.
Yes. It's like, you know, the sciences are one way to explore a world that is pregnant with meaning, even in its very... Right. Physical structure, you know, all the way down to like quantum mechanics. There's a reason, like the deeper, you know, astrophysicists go one way and the deeper biologists go another way, the less atheistic you become. Mm-hmm. Right? You may not become a Christian, but at some point you start flirting with intelligent design or something because you're like, yeah, this is like a massive, incomprehensible, mysterious order that we are just barely scratching the surface of. So as the sciences are like one way of exploring existence, mainly the physical side of existence, the humanities is also a way of exploring existence. Mainly like...
That's right.
You know, exploring the... I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish because science feels like it's a part of culture. But you understand what I mean. It's like it's almost like there are two ways to view the world. One views purely the physical mechanical operations of it. And the other one is exploring something in addition to that.
Yes.
It may include that because it may have thoughts about science as science affects culture, but it's some kind of cultural, philosophical, it's cultural. Hmm. Like there's culture in the physical world. There's human culture and nature. Culture and nature, let me put it that way. Humanities is a way to explore existence through the culture, and science is a way that explores it through nature. And if you see it that way, well, I mean, a scientist would say there's something there to know. Right? And like I said, the deeper you go into it, the more you feel like there's something more there than you even thought to know.
Yes.
There really is a deep something there. If you see it that way, then suddenly you realize, well, the humanities is about knowing something that matters. It's not just about becoming a smarter person, right? Which is what the first definition makes it sound like. Well, you'll get greater insight and understanding. You'll be a, you'll be a smart cookie, you know, or something like that. And it's like, no. Saying you'll become wiser is different than saying you'll become smarter.
That's true.
Right? Because wiser is like you're actually learning truths and virtues and wisdoms that matter, that have an import,
that's right.
That have impact in your life.
The assumption from the Christian perspective is that God intended certain things to happen the way they do, and that he built things with natures, let's say, the nature of a dog, the nature of a cat. And so on. There are things, and so wisdom is learning what those natures are, discovering what those natures are, and then living in accordance with them, which is what the farmer does all the time, right? He knows something about how seeds grow and how they produce fruit and so on, but he has to learn about soils and about what sort of things this plant needs this and this plant needs that and so on. He's learning the natures of things.
Right. If he tried to be purely self-expressive, he might not ever grow any crops.
Right.
Right. But by learning the real natures of things and how to work within them, there is actually, if I could put it this way, a place for self-expressiveness that dances in harmony with those.
Very things. Well said. Yeah, I love that dancing idea,
right?
Because you're really kind of working together with it, cooperating with it. But wisdom would be to know what those natures were, right?
Yes.
Are, let's say. Yeah, and here's another point. You're saying that science might get to know through the material world through nature. And culture is the work of knowing things through the arts or about
right.
through
like knowing the physical, and then there's a way to know the spiritual.
The spiritual side. But the funny thing is, those two things actually do overlap.
They do.
And that is that you, in a sense, need a philosophy of science.
Yes.
You see, you need, and the philosophy of science doesn't come from science. Nope. It comes from the humanities.
Are you listening, Neil deGrasse Tyson? Are you listening?
Yeah, yeah.
He'll just say something that's like, well, science knows this. And it's like, no, that's a philosophic statement, not a scientific statement.
So it seems like there's a relationship between the scientific study of natures and the cultural study of the spiritual, in that the spiritual side actually dictates meaning to the other. That is, science can't exist without a philosophy of science. And you don't get a philosophy of science from science. Right. You get it from the cultural side.
That's what the Neil deGrasse Tysons of the world don't understand. And I apologize constantly mentioning him. I'm not trying to pick on him, but I kind of am. It's
just a good example, though.
He'll say things. I remember, like, when I was roommating with someone a friend of mine who was like a philosophy major.
Yeah.
Neil deGrasse Tyson would say things about how we don't need philosophy. Science can solve it all. My friend, like, wanted to pull his hair out and be like, that's a philosophic statement.
Exactly.
That's not a scientific statement.
That's right. He doesn't learn that from the lab.
It's like, you have, even science comes, because it's a human enterprise, is going to have some kind of spiritual, moral, metaphysical, theological context to it, even if you don't even think in those terms when you're doing it.
That's right.
It's sort of just tacitly there, you know.
And it's the same model we've been talking about, the relationship between the invisible and the visible aspects of reality. I mentioned that in my little definition here. That is that reality is a bigger thing than just the material, but it's more than just that there are two parts. It's that the spiritual, the invisible part, actually dictates the meaning of the material part. Mm-hmm. So all the metaphoric meaning that you were talking about with the vine and branch and the door and all those things, and I was saying too, that metaphorical meaning actually comes in a sense one direction.
Yes.
You know, it comes from the spiritual to the material and gives the material meaning.
Yes.
And now we can deal with the material as it really is, that it's a, not only is it its own material thing, but it points to things beyond itself. And that comes from the spiritual side. Mm-hmm. So you can't live only in material.
Yeah, and I think that's
But then you can't live with a dichotomous version either. You have to have an integrated version.
Yeah, because the truest version is that the philosophical, theological, metaphysical cashes out in the physical world in some way.
That's right.
That's like the deeper point behind Jesus using a metaphor at all, is that there's actually a spiritual reality there in the physical thing.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Even though that spiritual reality is the point, it's not supposed to negate the physical thing, because if you do, then you no longer have the spiritual reality, because how are you supposed to know it? How are you supposed to engage with it?
Human beings can't know it, engage with it that way. So we're not living in a sort of matrix, like the Matrix movie, where the material world is actually an illusion.
Right.
It's real.
Yeah.
But it's reality that has an added dimension of being able to point to the spiritual.
Yeah. So on the one hand, God made a physical universe and made us embodied.
Yes.
And apparently that's how he wants us to know him and how we can know him, right? And how we can know spiritual reality just through physical existence. And that's not accidental, arbitrary. Physicality, materiality is meant to be stained glass windows for the sun that is behind it.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And if you lose the stained glass windows and all you have is just the glaring light of the sun, that's no better than seeing nothing at all.
Mm.
I mean, it's a blindness from something rather than nothing, but still, it's just blindness.
Right.
Or with the stained glass window, you can at least see. But on the other hand, this is the meaning, one of the deeper meanings behind Jesus' distinction between like serving God and serving mammon, is that God is the one who gives meaning to the mammon, gives it its proper place, its proper direction. Now you know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mammon on its own cannot explain itself, which means there's really no guardrails to prevent it from you doing whatever you want, just the autonomous fallen self just doing whatever it wants with its stuff. You know, to serve mammon is in some ways to just serve yourself.
That's right.
Because mammon
can be... use mammon to serve yourself.
Mammon is flexible. It could be whatever, you know, to an extent, it's flexible. Right. I mean, at least that's the attitude. We want it to be flexible. But here's the thing. Mammon only has its meaning in God, which means if you bump into mammon and try and turn it into your servant or try to turn it into your master, you find out that it actually is the servant of another master.
Mm.
So mm-hmm. if you try to do things like, I don't know, my apologies, but I don't know, use technology to try and change your biological sex to match how you feel inside.
Yes.
And then you find out that your body really won't go there. Like, no matter how hard you try, it's always going to produce these hormones, and its chromosome is always going to be this way genetically.
Yeah.
And if you try to, you know, have your genitals changed, it's not going to accept it. Yeah. So only realize that mammon is not as flexible as you thought it was, because it's actually the servant of someone else.
Mm.
And so in a way, in a weird way, making mammon your god is making yourself your god, but then trying to make mammon your god, you just constantly bump up against the fact that I'm not God.
Yeah.
There's somebody else.
Yeah.
So the whole thing of trying to serve mammon is just absurd on its face.
Right. Right.
And you literally, you literally cannot serve God and mammon, because even if you try to serve mammon, you find out that it serves God. So you don't have a choice one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the nature of nature.
Yes.
Is the way God has made the world to be. And again, we have to be willing to submit ourselves to the reality that we find ourselves in, rather than constantly autonomously. We've even done a podcast about this, about autonomously making decisions and having a kind of free will, a will that is completely free of any connection to anything and can do with material world anything it wants. It just isn't possible.
Mm-hmm.
We still have to wrestle with gravity. We still have to wrestle with breathing and so on, breathing air and not ammonia or something. So there are limits to all those things. The humanities are extremely important then, because it teaches us to have a vision for that spiritual application to the material that gives us wisdom about the material.
Right.
So without the humanities, actually we'll eventually lose the sciences, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Right? Because we'll use the sciences, not unlike some of the, even the 17th century scientists who really are modern, the modern scientists who would argue like Bacon did that knowledge is power. You know, knowledge of the way things are is somehow you being able to control the way things are. But that's a step too far.
Yeah.
Knowledge of the way things are is a wisdom so that you might be able to be more human, that is, accept the gods, accept the job that God has given us before the fall to name the animals, to tame the world, basically, to put the garden aright, to be fruitful and multiply, apply, so that we can fill the earth and cultivate it so that it is now properly fulfilled, and all of that stuff can be done if we learn how to relate to the way that God actually made things to be. If we reject that and say we are the ones in charge, then we're going to end up with abuse of the natural world. And in a sense, like Lewis says in The Abolition of Man, we may think that we are actually controlling the world, but what we're doing is we're reducing ourselves to ourselves, and not to the meaning that God has given us. Right. And as a result, we're reducing ourselves to our appetites. And as we reduce ourselves to our appetites,
we become enslaved to our appetites.
We become a slave to the world and to the devil and to everything else.
Right.
So we're actually putting ourselves into chains by rejecting the humanities. And to reject the humanities means to reject the Christ that is the picture of the humanities. So anyway, I think there is a place for a full-orbed, revelation-inspired or informed view of the humanities that needs to be regained.
Right. I agree.
Maybe we better wrap up, though.
Sure. Recommendations. We haven't done that in a while.
I've got one. Are you ready? I've got one. I'd like to recommend a fairly new book. I think it came out in February this year, by a fellow called Michael Behe.
Yeah.
You may remember Michael Behe because he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box back in the early 2000s, maybe.
Yes.
And a brilliant book about intelligent design. Well, I think he's gone even a little further now, and he's written a book called Darwin Devolves.
Okay.
Very interesting. Darwin devolves the new science about DNA that challenges evolution.
Interesting.
It's new science, and I think everybody ought to take a look. Of course, he hasn't got a lot, gotten a lot of support from the scientific community yet, but Dr. Behe teaches science. I think he's a molecular biologist. Don't quote me on that one. Sure. Something like that, but something very specific.
Look him up on Wikipedia.
He's at Lehigh University and is very respected as a scientist, but now not so much respected because he's questioning some things about the Darwin theory.
Although I've heard that, you know, there are things happening. It always felt like the staunch dogmatic holdout on these things of like intelligent design and stuff was in the biological sciences. Like when you went to astrophysics or even physics, they're still atheists and stuff like that. But you could find more people who are like, yeah, there's something weird. Yeah, there's some. Yeah, I don't know. There's
I can't explain there's that something, big
something,
bang thing.
You know, there's something going on. But in biology, it always seemed like there was a hard, stiff holdout. Because there is such a thing as, like, transformation over generations and stuff like that within a species or something like that. There is such a thing. But it seems, I've heard lately more rumblings that even in the biological sciences, they're starting, the deeper they go, the more they go, the more they're kind of like, okay, there's something weird. Like, there's some article in, might have been the New York Times, but don't quote me on that, about the evolution of beauty or beauty and evolution. It was a very long article, so if you try to find a pack of lunch when you read it, but it basically was about how beauty is confounding scientists. How it arose and why it arose and why it even worked, and it's making them have to rethink evolution somewhere.
Very interesting.
So I wouldn't be surprised if Behe doesn't eventually, if not already, I think he's getting more and more attention.
Yeah.
You know, his type of arguments are getting more and more attention. So that's a good book to start with.
Well, that Black Box book, I think, was more about, specifically about intelligent design from the biological aspect. And he speaks at length about the cell and how complicated the cell is and how many functions the cell has to do in some sort of order in order to be able to live.
To be a cell.
To be a cell, exactly. But this is going to be about the DNA and how the new understanding, the deeper understanding of DNA has actually begun to bring doubts about Darwinism.
I have a book. It is so on the so that's the science side of things. Yep. On the culture side of things, there's a guy named B.R. Meyer. His full name is something else. Maybe it's Bertrand Russell Meyer. But anyway, he goes under the name B.R. Meyer, M-Y-E-R-S. And he's a literary critic and scholar, I believe. And somewhere in the early 2000s, he wrote a book that is currently not in print, but you can find it through Amazon and get it. And I recommend you get it. It's called A Reader's Manifesto, An Attack on the Growing Pretentiousness in American Literary Prose. This book, A Reader's Manifesto, is an absolute intelligent, academic pillaring and takedown of all of literary writing as a concept.
Interesting.
He basically takes the main ideas that get espoused in it and demonstrates how if you actually study it point by point, it is atrocious writing. So okay. I'm a Cormac McCarthy fan.
Yeah, so
just as for reasons that are a little too personal and specific to get into. But The Road is something I've read like three times. All right. He has a chapter in this book called Muscular Prose, which is one of like the highlights of literary writing. And I read that chapter out loud to my friend who introduced this book to me, and my gosh, I'm like, oh no, oh no, oh no. The road still matters to me, but now I'm probably not going to be able to unsee. Mm. Like, I always kind of knew that, that's just how McCarthy writes. Now when I actually, like, try to study or look at something he said, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, I would have been slammed if I tried to write something like this.
Interesting.
And so it is, if you're someone who wants to be a writer, and you maybe have run into this notion of literary writing, and it makes you feel wholly inadequate, because, you know, something about incomprehensibility equals brilliance, I suggest this little book to you. It will, again, I caution you, not all literary writing is bad, or writing that calls itself literary is bad, but this will steel you against the notion that somehow it alone holds the reins to, like, writing. Good writing, good storytelling tells a story and tells it well. It's about plot and sentences. You can't divide those two. And there is an attitude that tries to divide those two And if you want to be a storyteller, you ought to resist it. You ought to strive to write beautiful sentences, but beautiful sentences that are in service to the plot. All right. And so if you want to, if you're going to go into an MFA program anywhere, I suggest before you do it, take the summer beforehand or the Christmas break beforehand. Get B.R. Meyer's book, A Reader's Manifesto, out of print, but there's still copies of it floating around there on Amazon. Find it, read it. It's real short. And enjoy yourself because it is hysterical in a lot of ways.
Very good.
And, yeah, that's all I got.
Very good.
So
we'll wrap up.
We'll wrap up. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.